the transmitter.
In January 2023, I came across a research paper with the main title, Mind the NIH Funding Gap. It examined NIH grants awarded to autism researchers from 1985 to 2021, and it showed that the National Institutes of Health had awarded zero grants to work that focused on improving health conditions in autistic adults through intervention, programs, or services. The authors claimed that this was not a funding hole or an oversight, but structural discrimination by the NIH against autistic adults. And they wrote that most of the grants that the NIH did fund around autism were actually, in their words, eugenics. Almost as an aside, the authors wrote that they had been discouraged from speaking out about this because the federal government might retaliate, and this had a chilling effect on the kind of whistleblowing that they were trying to do. These were shocking claims, almost outrageous. I looked at the first author on the paper, a researcher from Vanderbilt University named T. A. Meridian McDonald, and I realized that I knew her. We had met in 2022 at an autism research conference where she had told me she was onto something big. Discrimination at the NIH, she said, the largest funder of autism research in the world. Here she is, recalling researching her paper.
There was the period when I was first in the middle of it all and experiencing what I was experiencing, that I still hadn't figured out the way to proceed. Like, how do I best proceed? What is the right way to proceed? But, you know, I remember talking to someone that I knew about things that were going on. And as I was talking about some of the things, they literally were saying, like, be careful.
Reading her article, I began to wonder why Tempest Alexandria Meridian McDonald, or T.A. McDonald, as she sometimes goes by, or Tempest, as I tend to call her, had written a paper with such a knives-out tone. I went online and pretty quickly saw that Tempest had overcome a chaotic youth and had climbed a long way to her current position. I also saw that she was autistic herself and had an autistic son, and I thought she might have a unique view into autism research, so I called her. As we talked, I began to understand how her lived experience and her life as a parent fueled her research, and saw how both things informed her NIH funding gap paper. And when I began to talk to others in the autism field, I saw that her paper was pointing towards something true. Here's Emily Hotez, a project scientist at the Autism Intervention Research Network on Physical Health, also called AIRP. She is a developmental psychologist and assistant professor at UCLA, and she has an autistic sister.
This paper, to me, really illuminated this kind of pervasive, vicious cycle that exists between research, education, practice, and policy that we clearly see the effects of on autistic people through their health data.
So Tempest was not the only person who thought something was wrong with how autism research is funded. Yet in the months following her paper publication, things in her life collapsed. The NIH paper, she told me, created tension for her at Vanderbilt, and she eventually lost her postdoc position. And then she left academia entirely and became a counselor. The reality of autism research is that the amount of money spent on investigating the lives of autistic adults is far, far below what is spent on looking at children. And as I investigated this, I realized that people have been complaining about this disparity for years, and nothing much has been done about it. My name is Brady Huggett. This is When Autistic Kids Grow Up, and this is Chapter 1, Those People. Tempest's father, Terry, grew up in Reynoldstown, which in the 1940s and 50s was a mostly poor neighborhood in Atlanta, Georgia. His own father, a man named Armis Stonewall McDonald, was kind of an oddball, Terry told me. And they had a hardscrabble life. Armis hawked watermelons and flowers and sold Christmas trees in the winter. On weekends, he threw discarded and found items into the back of his truck and drove out to rural Georgia to sell it, kind of like a traveling junkyard, Terry said. Terry himself was introverted, he told me. He spent a lot of time alone, a lot of time reading, picking up books from the Goodwill store across the street from his house. But while he became a great reader, he had been a late speaker. Here's Terry.
I was, I guess my language was more like my neighbors, them, those, these, and there, and rather than them, those, these. I didn't have THs, and I couldn't say Rs, and Ws gave me a lot of problems for some reason.
Neurodiversity was not even a concept in those years, but there are enough signs in his past that Terry thinks he exhibited autistic traits.
Did you consider yourself autistic?
More than likely I was. Yeah. They didn't have diagnoses back then with that, of course. But yeah.
By 1966, Terry had married a young woman named Alex. But when his draft notice came for the Vietnam War, he enlisted and left Alex behind for boot camp and then Vietnam.
I saw a lot of violence when I was growing up. And so when I went in the Army, we were very poor. When I went in the Army, there's two things that I noticed. I really, really liked the clothing. It was really high-quality clothing, and they gave you a lot of it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, I even loved the dress uniforms and stuff.
Yeah.
And when I went to Vietnam, I know most people would be afraid of that with them, but I didn't really see a reason to be afraid because I was surrounded by an army, right, which is protection.
Yeah.
And they give you a rifle, you know, so I actually felt safer in Vietnam than I did growing up.
Terry spent part of his time in the war as a perimeter guard for an aviation company that flew spy missions over North Vietnam. Meanwhile, Alex filed for divorce, and when Terry came back to Atlanta, he found everything changed. His ex-wife had gone to New York City with a strange man who had left behind a young woman and their child, now staying in Terry's house. This did not seem to be Terry's problem, and he'd been assigned to the basic combat training facility in Fort Sill, Oklahoma. He packed up his car to leave, but the woman and her son simply climbed into the car with him. This is how her parents met. It's a story, Tempest told me, about people surviving.
She's desperate. She's desperate. I mean, being a single mother is hard, period. But at that time, how do you get a job? How do you survive? How do you take care of your child? How do you exist? And my dad's attitude was, well, you know, he can't. What's he going to do? You know, so off they went. And that was basically their relationship.
The woman's name was Mary Carroll. The little boy, his name was Charles. Mary Carroll was partially French-Canadian, had been born in Quebec City, Quebec, and had been raised in Catholic boarding schools. But she'd run away to the streets of New York City at 14 with her older sister, Tempest told me. By the time Terry, Mary Carroll, and Charles arrived in Fort Sill, they had formed a makeshift family. When Terry was discharged, the family went back to Georgia. They spent 7 months camping at Lake Lanier, a 38,000-acre reservoir formed when the Chattahoochee River was dammed in the 1950s. Today, it's a popular weekend getaway spot for Atlantans, and it might be recognizable from the Netflix show Ozark, which was partly shot there. Anyway, from there, Terry hitchhiked to nearby towns to look for work until he landed a job and they bought a car. They used the car to go to Jacksonville, Florida, in search of a job, but it never panned out. Then Terry read a National Geographic article about homesteading in Alaska and decided to take the family north. Terry and Mary Carroll married in Edmonton, Alberta, along the way, and arrived to Alaska in August 1971. The snow began on September 1st, and they didn't see the ground again until the spring thaw, Terry told me. The family was fully unprepared for what lay ahead of them.
Well, we found this cabin way out, way, way out, and we could rent it for $30 a month. And so we did, but there was no electricity, no running water and stuff, so my wife, it was really cold. We really needed some food. And so we're walking. I've only got two bullets, right? We're walking, and another thing I didn't realize was batteries freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't use flashlights. After a while, they freeze, you know.
Yeah.
And so she was in front of me striking matches. Now you got to remember, snow everywhere, so it's sort of bright anyway. But this particular night, it was overcast, so we didn't get much moonlight or starlight. So she was striking matches, following this trail, a moose trail in the snow. And she tracked it right up to his butt. I mean, she struck a match, and there's the moose.
Oh, my God.
And the rifle had a scope, and I threw it up to shoot the moose. And I saw something go past the light, and I pulled the trigger, right? But whatever it was kept going, so we were kind of depressed, and we're sitting there.
And now you're down to one bullet.
Well, we're sitting there all depressed, you know, on a falling over tree and trunk. And we heard something go thud. And I said, wow, maybe that was the moose fell dead, fell down. And so we start walking in a big old round circle, trying to, because you couldn't tell where it came from with the trees and all that stuff. And about, I guess, maybe 50 yards away, we found the moose. And I shot it in the head.
It was with a one shot you shot?
With that one shot, yeah.
According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Fairbanks recorded a low of negative 49 degrees Fahrenheit that January, with a string of 15 days where the temperature did not climb above negative 20. Terry told me he thought it was very lucky we didn't die. But the moose gave them meat, and he used the skin to make snowshoes and stuffed the hair of the animal into burlap sacks for extra insulation around their clothing. And it's this moose story, before Tempest was even born, that seems most emblematic of Tempest's childhood to me. A life lived at times on the edge, with parents perhaps naive about the endeavor in front of them, but guided by a father who knows how to survive. And Tempest would grow up to be a survivor too. Tempest was born in Fairbanks, Alaska, in 1972. A late birth, and she arrived big at 10 pounds with a head of hair. She was also blue, Tempest told me, due to birth complications. By this time, Terry was working as a draftsman with the borough of Fairbanks, North Star. But when he lost that job, their northern existence began to feel untenable. The family left Alaska for Savannah, Georgia, where Terry got a job refurbishing blast furnaces for the Continental Can Company. They bought a used car and settled into a small home in the Wilmington Island neighborhood of Savannah, at the edge of the Wilmington River. One afternoon, as Mary Carroll sat reading a book in the front yard and baby Tempest lay sleeping in the back seat of the car, a tree quietly, almost casually, came down on top of it. Mary Carroll pulled her daughter out as the weight of the tree was slowly crushing the roof, the local paper reported. Eyewitnesses told the paper it was a windless day, and the tree just creaked a little as it fell. Tempest suffered just a cut behind her ear. At times, later in her life, Tempest would wonder, what if her mother had been breastfeeding in the car? What if a limb had skewered the top of the car? What if the tree had been bigger and fallen faster? Any change to the specifics of that story, she marveled, in the incident would have been a tragedy.
The family described it that way. My mother was utterly shocked by it because she describes hearing like squirrels, like it was nuts falling or acorns falling, or like you're hearing some noises, but you don't think much of it. It was the tree cracking before it falls over. It wasn't like it made a big crack sound. That story was being told, you know, I'm 9 and 10 years old, that story is being told.
This event, coupled with the fact that she had been born blue, became one of the many near misses in her life, she said, and it helped form her self-concept. Starting in her childhood and extending into her adult years, Tempest understood that death was always right there, she said, just a breath away. The family relocated to North Atlanta. Terry took a series of maintenance jobs at apartment complexes, and the family moved from one to another, angling toward better neighborhoods. In these early years, often Mary Carroll spent the day in bed. There was something strange going on there, and it had started not too long after Tempest's birth. It had to do with Mary Carroll's metabolism. She was frantic and irritable and getting shockingly thin. Terry told me he was feeding her 2,000 calories a day, and she was still losing weight. And Tempest said that at one point her mother drifted all the way down to 85 pounds. This went on for about 3 years before a doctor figured out that it was Graves' disease, hyperthyroidism. When it's untreated, it can lead to increased heart rate, sweating, weight loss, and nervousness, among other symptoms, and by the time she was diagnosed, The damage had been done to Mary Carroll, Terry said, on both her body and mind. Here's Tempest.
When I was very young, she couldn't get out of bed. My dad would go to work, my brother would go to school, and what I would have to do is drag the milk, the gallon of milk, down the hallway to the bedroom and try to get it up on the bed. And once it was on the bed, then I'd try to set up the cereal and I'd try to pour the milk and she would be able to stabilize it a little bit so that I could like have a bowl of cereal. I'd eat my cereal and then, I mean, I wasn't allowed out of the house because if something happened to me, no one knew. There was no one to make sure I would be okay.
But there was more going on with Mary Carroll too. Much later in her life, she would get an autism diagnosis. That, Tempest told me, made a lot of sense.
When I grew up with her, I would have to explain her to people. I'd tell people, I'd say, you know how like some people are tone deaf? She's social deaf. So she's not going to understand your jokes. And she's not going to understand your tone of voice. And the eggshells were real, very real. And, you know, the diagnosis of autism wasn't around at the time. But my mother was the person who had to cut out all the tags out of the clothes. She couldn't only wear certain types of clothes. She had problems with the inseams and the outer seams. She actually would take her socks and remove all the elastic out of it because she couldn't handle the pressure that socks had on. And she was a slender woman. And so if she was eating, she could tell if someone had come into the house because the food tasted different. Like it would change the flavor of the food. She was a very sensitive person. And she had meltdowns a lot.
The meltdowns might be related to autism, Tempest thinks. But Tempest also thinks her mother's time in the Catholic boarding schools might have traumatized her. Mary Carroll lacked self-regulation skills, Tempest told me. And she lost her temper often. Terry told me that his wife was violent with Tempest as a girl. Especially when he wasn't around, he said, slapping her head and stuff like that. All of this has left Tempest with mixed feelings.
She's a complex person, but I think she also, and my father thinks this too, when she had Graves' disease, she got lost a lot of weight. She became emaciated. She nearly died. And there's possibility that there was brain damage. And so it's really hard for me to work in the disability spaces that I do and turn my eye on my mother and judge her harshly without taking these things into consideration. But I do know that I was in great need of protection from her.
Mary Carroll did help nurture Tempest's mind, though. And she bought school supplies and phonics books and kept them around the house. That helped Tempest get the basics of reading down before she even got to kindergarten, she told me. And then her father supplied her with books, often ones that he had just finished reading. Still, when she went to school, she struggled to connect with the other children. Partly this was because of her appearance, she said. With her father grinding away on jobs and her mother ill, she arrived at school looking unkempt, she said, even uncared for. And she did not think the teachers gave her much consideration either.
And now I think that there's a lot more teachers who care about marginalized students.
Yeah.
But I don't think that they really were the teachers at the time. I think there was a time in our history where people just thought of those people. And, oh, she's one of those people. You know, and they have a sense of where I'm going to end up.
In 1983, Tempest thinks, her parents split up for about a year. Tempest stayed with her father until they reconciled, and then the family rented a houseboat docked at Lake Lanier. Tempest liked that. In the morning, she'd wake to the sound of rigging clanking against the masts of sailboats, or hear carp thumping against the bottom of the boat. But one night, the family got into a car accident while going north on I-85, a major thoroughfare that cuts through Georgia and Atlanta. They had just done laundry and were on their way back to the houseboat. Tempest was in the back seat, a bag of clothes on either side of her, when an 18-wheeler crossed lanes and hit the back of their car.
He sent us, sailing off towards this concrete bridge support So my dad, you know, turned the car sharply to the left so we wouldn't crash into the concrete bridge support. But then the tractor trailer hit us again, fully on our side, destroyed the vehicle. I mean, destroyed it. Every bit of glass gone. And like all the tires had come off the road. And by the time our vehicle, we were kind of like stuck on the tractor trailer. But we came off of it. And three things I really remember about that was that my dad got out of the car. Like as soon as he got the vehicle to a stop, he was out of the vehicle and running down the road to the tractor trailer just to see if he would even stop. But I remember my mother got out and she's like roaming the street trying to look at she's in shock. Yeah. We were all in shock. Yeah. We were in the strange, she's like, it was almost like something out of like a Twin Peaks novel, the way she's walking down the road, trying to look at like this, what the accident stripes might look like. But I was looking at where my dad was sitting in the car because the tractor trailer had caved his door in and there was no space for him to exist in the vehicle.
Terry fractured 3 vertebrae, Tempest said. The family moved back into Atlanta for his doctor visits, and then her parents divorced. Tempest again stayed with her father, and she entered Crestwood High School. There, she hung out with the outcasts and stoners, she told me, smoking marijuana, dropping acid. Her grades were poor. Her sophomore year, Terry took up with a new woman named Cheryl, who had 2 boys of her own, Tempest said. All 3 moved in with Tempest and her father in a rental house in a new neighborhood, and Tempest started at a new high school. And then something terrible happened, and it blew the family apart. The way Tempest tells it, she was upstairs talking to Charles on the phone. He was grown up and living on his own by then. She was describing a devastating event, she said. House phones were still hardwired then and all on the same line. Anyone picking up an extension could overhear a conversation. And Cheryl picked up the downstairs line and overheard some of what Tempest was saying to Charles. And then Cheryl handed the phone to Terry, and he listened too. When Tempest came downstairs, Cheryl and Terry demanded that she admit the things she'd been saying on the phone weren't true. If she wouldn't do that, then she would need to leave the house. The problem, Tempest said, was that it was true, and she would not take any of it back. And so she left. She had just turned 16 years old. When I asked for more details on the devastating event, she would not answer. It is the only question over many hours of interviews that she declined to discuss. But the details of why she left home are not the point. The point is, she left the house. And because she was estranged from her mother, she had no place to go. Like her mother had once been, Tempest was now a teenager on the streets of a city. But she had grown up like her father, and she would find a way. That is in Chapter 2. When Autistic Kids Grow Up was written and produced by me, Brady Huggett. Editing by Ivan Aransky and Paige Miranda. Art commissioned by Rebecca Horn. Music and audio engineering by Sam Schumann. Rest in peace to Mary Carroll, Tempest's mother, who passed away some years ago. Go to the podcast page of thetransmitter.org to see photographs for this chapter and a PDF transcript. Thank you.